WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, inside the spy catcher's world, we talk with Stuart Harrington, a retired Army colonel, about his work as a military intelligence officer during the Cold War, investigating American spies who were selling secrets to the Soviets. He's written a new book called Traitors Among Us. Also, we meet clarinetist Ken Poplawski. He played in the Benny Goodman Orchestra shortly before Goodman's death. Poplawski's new CD is a tribute to the songs and arrangements associated with the Goodman Band. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A jury in Miami has announced its findings in a class-action lawsuit against the tobacco industry filed on behalf of smokers. The panel found that cigarettes cause lung cancer, emphysema, and other illnesses. NPR's Debbie Elliott says this verdict could be significant, exposing the tobacco industry to billions of dollars in damages.
Probably the biggest case in the tobacco wars. For years and years, the tobacco industry has been successful in fending off civil lawsuits, saying that smokers have known the risks for years, yet they choose to smoke anyway. Well, this jury says, well, wait a minute. Tobacco companies conspire to misrepresent the health effects of smoking. They try to hide the dangers of smoking. They addicted people to a dangerous and defective product.
NPR's Debbie Elliott. The next phase of the trial will deal with damages. Lawyers for the plaintiffs are seeking at least $200 billion for about 500,000 Florida smokers and their relatives. President Clinton visited the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota today, talking with Oglala Sioux residents about the area's poverty, inadequate housing, and unemployment. The visit was part of the president's four-day tour of impoverished rural and urban areas as he promotes an effort to bring business investment to what the administration says are untapped markets. In Pine Ridge, the president announced water projects to be implemented by the Department of Agriculture and said no place in the U.S. should be without safe running water and sewer. On his first full day in office, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak said that he'll begin his initiative for Mideast peace with talks this week. Mike O'Connor reports from Jerusalem.
Barak was elected the middle of last month, and he's been criticized for taking until last week to gather together a majority coalition in the legislature. But with that done, and with his swearing in yesterday, he's beginning to take the steps he promised on peace negotiations. Early Friday, he is to fly to Egypt to meet with President Mubarak. It's scheduled as a short meeting over breakfast. There may be more symbolism than progress to the meeting. Many Arab leaders have seemed optimistic about Barak's election, but they've been waiting for him to do something. So even a symbolic meeting could be a welcomed first step. On Sunday, Barak is to see President Arafat, the Palestinian leader. In a week, Barak is scheduled to go to Washington. That's to be the longest visit of all, 4 days. For NPR News, I'm Mike O'Connor in Jerusalem.
Federal officials say an Illinois man has admitted to illegally selling the two guns used in the weekend shooting spree that left three people dead in Illinois and Indiana. Donald Feisinger is accused of selling the guns to gunman Benjamin Smith, who killed himself on Sunday as police tried to arrest him. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials gained 52 points today to close at a record 11,187. This is NPR. Attorneys for Terry Nichols have requested a new trial, saying prosecutors and investigators failed to produce thousands of documents that could have prevented Nichols from being convicted of conspiracy and involuntary manslaughter in the Oklahoma City bombing trial. Nichols is currently serving a life sentence for his part in the bombing. Defense attorney Michael Tiger said prosecutors still haven't turned over thousands of so-called lead sheets from the FBI, documents that are used to record information from informal interviews or from callers. Prosecutors responded that the lead sheets would not have changed the outcome of Nichols' trial. Hot winds are fanning wildfires in many western states. Jill Hoyt reports from member station KBSX in Boise, Idaho.
315 wildfires are burning in the west, according to the National Interagency Fire Center based in Boise. In Southern California, high winds fanned a fire that destroyed one home. More are threatened near Cajun Pass. Helicopters and air tankers are making slow progress in a large fire complex along the Utah-Colorado border. Officials hope that remote wildfire will be contained Thursday. In central Idaho, high winds delayed smoke jumpers trying to parachute into forested mountains to battle a new blaze near Stanley. Scattered storms and strong winds are forecast for tonight, prompting officials to post a fire weather watch for Oregon, Washington, Wyoming, and Idaho. For NPR News, I'm Jill Hoyt in Boise.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today. The NASDAQ Composite Index gained 6 points to close at 2,743. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Stuart Harrington, spent most of his life in the world of spies and double agents. He served 30 years as an Army military intelligence officer. From 1988 to 92, he directed the FCA, the Foreign Counterintelligence Activity, which was responsible for pursuing the most damaging cases of espionage committed against the U.S. by the Soviets. He's written a new book called Traitors Among Us, Inside the Spycatcher's World. The case of Clyde Lee Conrad, which Harrington worked on and writes about in the book, has a few parallels to the current Chinese espionage story. Conrad was an American military officer who spent most of his career in West Germany. He ran a spy ring that sold secret American documents to the Soviets detailing NATO defense plans in the event of a Soviet attack on Eastern Europe. After a long investigation by the Foreign Counterintelligence Activity, Conrad was tried and convicted of high treason in Germany and sentenced to life. He died in prison last year at the age of 50. Conrad was the custodian of the top-secret documents that he ended up selling.
Conrad worked in the G3, which is the Operations and Plans and Training section of the 8th Infantry Division, and essentially as a sergeant, staff sergeant and sergeant first class in that section. His job was to work the war plans and the annual revisions of the war plans, which dealt with how that division would react, where it would go, and what it would do in the event of a war. He was a clever fellow, however, and he used that position in order to obtain war plans for adjacent units, other units, higher level units, and amassed for himself, just by virtue of being in the war plans job, a huge family of war plans that he could then betray, in this case, to the Hungarian Military Intelligence Service, which passed them on to Moscow.
Now, what was his motivation for selling the secrets? Was it ideology or just money?
Money. To Conrad, the Cold War, in his mind's eye, he rationalized that the Cold War was a great game, that there never really would be a war, and therefore smart people like Conrad, who sold the war plans and profited from it, were far ahead of those who took the whole thing seriously and did their job.
Now, in the book, you describe how his reputation among his superiors was that he was great. He was like the model employee, but he had a different reputation to soldiers.
Yes, Conrad was, as I said in the book, a chameleon. He was certainly a highly respected non-commissioned officer in the headquarters of the 8th Infantry Division and stayed there year after year. He'd made himself the indispensable man, and he was the perfect soldier to his superiors. But amongst his non-commissioned officer peers, and above all, amongst the younger enlisted people who looked to him as a role model and a father figure, he was a cynical, Machiavellian, and quite honestly greedy fellow and an opportunist who made no secret about his contempt for authority.
And someone who would occasionally approach, you know, a soldier and say, you want to make a little money on the side?
He did that, and one of the lessons learned from the saga of Clyde Lee Conrad and his co-conspirators, something we've known all along, which is soldiers are very reticent to squeal on anybody who's got anything going on the side, at least during that period of time, the peer pressure to keep your mouth shut, and you know, people knew Clyde had something going, and he gave a different excuse for why he was, you know, getting his money and for offering these jobs to different soldiers. But nobody, almost nobody, walked in and said, hey, I think something's wrong with Conrad. You need to look closely at him.
Well, what intelligence ended up doing was taking one of the intelligence agents and basically making him a double agent. This was somebody named Danny Wilson, who Conrad had approached once and said, you know, you want to make some money on the side, hoping that he could sell secrets. And explain how you used Danny Wilson as a double agent.
Well, it was a gambit, you know, and it was a bold gambit that was actually commenced by my predecessor, a colonel named Bob Lund, wherein they'd identified Conrad, and it sure looked like he was the man. He'd had the access for the years. He had shown signs of undue affluence, more money than he should have had, gone from rags to riches. But the real challenge, of course, anytime you get a suspect in your sights, is to document the elements of the crime of espionage, and you've got to be more specific than just, he looks like our boy. So in this particular case, the decision was made to take a young soldier whom Conrad had approached with an opportunity to make some easy money a number of years earlier, almost a decade earlier, and who had, during interviewing, reported later, years later, to our agents that Conrad had asked him about a chance to make some quick money on the side, and essentially to transfer that soldier back into the area where he could restrike up a relationship with Conrad and just see if Conrad might take the bait, view the young soldier as someone who hadn't reported the problem at the beginning and therefore might be trustworthy, and he might take him into his confidence and try to recruit him. And that's what we did.
Did it work?
It worked. Conrad was apparently at that point in time, he'd recently retired. He didn't have direct access to secrets as he'd had in the past. He was what I called at the time the once-and-future spy. He'd like to have gotten back in the saddle and resumed his stature as the pride of Hungary's, of Budapest's agent stable. And when Danny Wilson walked into his life, Conrad, after an initial fright, thinking that Wilson might be there to actually apprehend him, saw daylight. He saw pure opportunity in his old friend Danny, and in a matter of months, he began to brag about his espionage career and ultimately recruited Danny with the dangling in front of him the visions of a lot of money to be made by a smart guy off this game called the Cold War.
What was your biggest frustration when you took over the Army's foreign counterintelligence activity in 1988? Your biggest frustration in terms of this case?
Well, I was told by my superiors when they gave me the new job that the case, which was called Canasta Player, was the major challenge, that the case had been open for a decade, that for more than 2 years Conrad had been identified, but closing on the target and collecting the information, which would then be assessed by prosecutors as adequate to lay hands on Conrad and arrest him, was the challenge. The word was out that the foreign counterintelligence activity had gotten a hold of this tiger by the tail called the suspect Clyde Lee Conrad and just didn't know how to bring the thing to a conclusion so that prosecutors could say, yes, we've got what we need. There's no question about it. The elements of the crime of espionage have been met. It's time to grab him.
What was the turning point in actually ending the case?
Well, I'd like to say that we had a great plan and we proceeded step by step, and the case ended on our terms. Actually, the turning point was at the time when we were doing well in manipulating the case to where we were collecting those elements of information about Conrad, such as where his money was, who was his Hungarian contact. A member of the media, one who's quite well-known today, Jeff Girth, actually picked up a tip in spite of all of the security surrounding this case. Jeff picked up a tip that this case was underway and approached the government to see if he could verify whether the tip was correct or not. And that approach by Jeff Girth was actually a traumatic event, and it forced us into going on a route to bring the case to an end that we had not planned to do, which was to go to our German colleagues in the then West German government and ask for assistance in arresting and prosecuting Conrad.
And that's why he ended up getting tried and and imprisoned in Germany.
That's correct. The Germans were as aggrieved a party as we were. In fact, you could argue even more aggrieved, since any war that would have resulted in catastrophe out of Conrad's betrayal would have been fought on the battlefield of West Germany, not in Pennsylvania. So what we had to essentially take a case that had a cloak of security around it so dense that we didn't dare tell the Germans about it, even though we'd been investigating for a decade in their country. And we had to go to the Germans, I had to go to the Germans and say, look, this is what we have been doing in your country behind your back. It was a deep secret, security was essential, and we now find ourselves in a position where the whole thing is on thin ice based upon a leak to the media. Our own prosecutors are not really ready to make the jump as to, you know, stepping up to the plate and prosecuting, and we need your help. And the Germans responded gratefully with a positive response, and the rest is history.
My guest is Stuart Harrington, and he directed the Army's foreign counterintelligence activity from 1988 to 92. He's written a new book called Traitors Among Us, Inside the Spy Catcher's World. You were based in Berlin during part of your career. What was it like working in Berlin during the Cold War?
Well, it was, of course, for those of us who were blessed to serve there, for professional and personal reasons, a great experience. Professionally, of course, Berlin was the mecca for espionage. It was what Istanbul was 75 years earlier, or Vienna, the place where the major adversaries in the Cold War came into direct contact, because the city itself was divided amongst communist and non-communist parties. And so from that perspective, it was professionally extremely gratifying, because you had the chance to actually lock horns with the adversary, whereas a lot of counterintelligence folks would spend a career and never get that opportunity. There were a lot of games being played in Berlin, and the watchword was that nothing is as it appears to be.
What's it like to work in a world where nothing is where it appears to be? Do you start to distrust everything, everybody?
Again, a wise observation on your part. I think one of the occupational illnesses of working in the counterintelligence arena is a tendency to become almost paranoid. Since nothing can be accepted at face value, you know, going across the line to where things are face value and how one copes with them, I think that's a real problem. It was for me and was for a lot of my agents. An innocuous phone call, for example, by someone, or an innocuous meeting in an airport terminal causes one to think, you know, I wonder if the reason she asked me that question is she's trying to get close to me. Why did she sit down next to me and strike up that conversation? Is she for real, or has someone instructed her to try and get close to me for the worst of possible reasons? Those kinds of thoughts and second guessing tend to characterize the way one becomes when one's subjected to that environment year after year.
Now, I'm wondering if the paranoia you describe also filters into the political level. In other words, if you risk becoming more paranoid about an enemy country than maybe they deserve. In other words, if you were more fearful about the Soviets during the Cold War than perhaps you needed to be.
Well, I think I say in Traitors Among Us that we certainly painted our adversary as a 10-foot-tall adversary, and intelligence people are very good at that, not because of the more cynical reasons evinced by the commentators on the system, namely that, you know, the threat is painted very, very overpainted and overdrawn greatly for resource reasons. But I think there's a very real tendency when you focus and focus intently on a target to begin to be a little bit cowed and overawed by that target and to overstate its threat. The Chinese case, for example, I read the Cox report, and I consider it to be tremendously overdrawn and worst-cased. And yet I can see in that the product of inputs from a lot of intelligence community folks.
What do you think is overdrawn about that report?
Well, I think it's the rhetoric largely. I mean, nobody would dispute that the Chinese government has a program in order to collect military intelligence and economic intelligence from the United States. And in that sense, the Chinese government's doing nothing more and nothing less than what all governments do, including our own. But the rhetoric with which the report is framed and the way it just, the overall sense and feeling of that report strikes me as, you know, somewhat evidence of the same kind of occupational paranoia that we've talked about.
My guest is retired Colonel Stuart Harrington. His new book is called Traitors Among Us. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. You're just joining us, my guest is Stuart Harrington, and he ran the Army's foreign counterintelligence activity from 1988 to 92. His new book is called Traitors Among Us, Inside the Spy Catcher's World. Now, you were in the position of being the Army's head counterintelligence agent at a time when the Cold War was ending. You say in your book you didn't see it coming.
Well, I wished I could say. It sounds like a broken record. I wished I could say that I'd seen it coming. But the truth of the matter is we were so completely consumed with the serious hemorrhages of national security that were on our plate and the need to focus on collecting the elements of the crime of espionage, not only on Clyde Conrad, but as readers will find out, there were a total of 11 co-conspirators of this ring, not to mention other cases that we had underway, that from the point of view of counterintelligence folks, we didn't see it coming. And I think if you look across the board at the performance of the U.S. government at the highest levels, that when Ronald Reagan said, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall," everybody snickered and it was regarded as just so much rhetoric. But the truth is that the Soviet system was shot through with vulnerabilities. They knew it better than anyone, particularly the KGB knew of the vulnerabilities better than anyone. And they had a better sense of their own system than we did, that's for sure.
You briefly describe in your book that after the Cold War, you were working on a project for which you ended up flying in the same plane as a former KGB official. And so you got a chance to, you know, share stories with your former arch foe. What was that experience like?
Well, you know, I had quite a lot of time to talk to this KGB colonel because we flew all the way across from Moscow to Vladivostok. You know, my first thought was I never thought in my career that I'd ever have the opportunity to sit on an aircraft and talk with one of these folks and watch him as he consumed the vodka and sausage that was, you know, his desire, and ever get a conversation going with him. And it was almost surrealistic. But equally interesting was to hear, you know, his view of things. For example, I'll never forget when he told me that Gorbachev was a CIA agent dispatched by the CIA or recruited by the CIA to destroy the Soviet Union.
He believed that.
He believed that right down to the very fiber of his existence, and that the whole fall of the Soviet Union was essentially a massively successful and orchestrated CIA plot.
Now, do you think that that's a symptom of the kind of paranoia that spies experienced that you were describing before?
More than that, Terry, what I saw in that was, and again, it wasn't just this one officer I got to talk to. I spent a lot of time talking with a lot of them. It was the institutional paranoia of the security services playing, you know, the mirror image of us, although far more amplified, I would say, plus the tremendous paranoia that tends to characterize the Russians, particularly now in the days when their superpower status is gone. There's a tremendous amount of paranoia and wound licking going on over there, and I had a chance to experience it firsthand.
Now, you're in private practice, I suppose I could say now. You're the manager of investigations for a major sporting goods company. I don't know the name of the country, and I'm not sure you'd want to name it yourself. But I think your presence there is really part of a trend in which former spies and detectives and FBI agents and CIA agents are going to work in private industry. And I'm wondering what you think that says.
Well, first of all, my skills are a pretty low-density skill, meaning that, you know, the average person out there doesn't really have a need to hire a spy catcher. Yet the investigative discipline itself, there are fields such as protecting the intellectual property of a sporting goods company, which is what I do, wherein protecting intellectual property, in this case, trademarks, patents, trade dress, there's an analogy there. You know, in my former life, I protected national security information from those who would take it in order to use it against us strategically. And in my new life, I essentially work for a very fine sporting goods company that is famous for its intellectual property protection. And the targets are no longer spies who would steal the information in order to give it to some hostile military power, but rather those who would steal the information in order to counterfeit products, to make knockoffs of products, or otherwise to disadvantage the public corporation for which I work and impact negatively on its stockholders and ultimately, in the macro sense, our national economy.
The atmosphere must be pretty different when you're trying to protect information from getting into the hands of opponent, you know, of competing businesses compared to trying to protect information, state secrets, from getting into the hands of, you know, enemy countries?
Well, in many cases, the countries are out there. It's actually a transnational thing. The people who are trying to get the information are in foreign countries, and they have very healthy, well-developed industries based on counterfeiting and the lack of respect for intellectual property. And in other cases, it's unscrupulous people who, I must say, these people are more unscrupulous and far more dangerous and cause me far greater worry than the spies we caught.
In what way are they more unscrupulous?
Well, what they will do in order to obtain the information and the kinds of attitude they take towards people who rain on their parade.
Did your people ever use James Bond kind of gizmos to help them find spies, find traitors?
Well, we had quite an array of electronic aids at our disposal, a lot of which to this very day are, you know, we don't talk about for smart reasons. You know, things like tracking beepers installed in a hidden place on Clyde Conrad's car so that our surveillance aircraft could keep track of him when he headed out of the village and got on the Autobahn. That sort of stuff, wiretaps and that sort of stuff was all a part of it. And again, you can't do that sort of electronic intrusion or those sorts of, you know, gee whiz type devices without some kind of approval, where you've got probable cause to suspect someone's loyalty. But we had a fair share of those arrows in our quiver.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if there were any gizmos that originated in the spy world that you've now seen filter down to, you know, like, say, the Sharper Image Catalog or, you know, just like consumer products.
Spy mania is alive and well in the United States, and you can go online now and you can buy a wide array of stuff, which... In the case of my agents, if one of us were to have gone out and bought that stuff for our own private use, we would have been in trouble. There are things that, as a government agent, you know, you can't mess with, and you're forbidden. An example is what you would call commonly burglar tools. We have our own lockpicking specialists in the government, but those tools and the possession of those tools are, you know, a special thing, and he's not allowed to take them out and keep them in the trunk of his car once he's trained in that specialty. So there's a lot of that spy stuff out there, wild stuff, electronic stuff, bugs of every shape, size, and description, pinhole cameras, you name it. It's all out there.
Well, Stuart Harrington, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it a lot.
Stuart Harrington's new book is called Traitors Among Us, Inside the Spy Catcher's World. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, clarinetist Ken Poplawski. His new CD is a tribute to the songs and arrangements associated with the Benny Goodman Band. Poplawski played in the band shortly before Goodman's death. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We often play music by clarinetist Ken Paplowski in between segments on Fresh Air. The 40-year-old musician is considered one of the best clarinetists of his generation. In addition to leading his own bands, he's played with Susanna McCorkle, Mel Torme, Hank Jones, and Ruby Braff. After spending much of his career trying to avoid comparisons with Benny Goodman, he's just released a new CD featuring songs and arrangements associated with the Goodman Orchestra. It's Paplowski's 16th CD for Concord Records. It's called Last Swing of the Century, and it presents the final concert of a 2-week tour of Japan by Paplowski and a 13-piece big band. The CD opens with the song that Goodman often opened with, Let's Dance. Ken Paplowski, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, you actually played with Benny Goodman in the last part of Goodman's life. How old were each of you at the time?
This was about 1986, and I would have been 26 at the time, and Benny was around 80 years old. And I was frightened to death, frankly, working with him, because I'd heard all these stories about him. And most of them weren't very good stories. I mean, he was known as kind of a terror on the bandstand, very tough band leader. I heard all these things about his personality, that he was very arbitrary in his dealings with musicians. He could just on a whim fire people and things like that. But I have to say, my experience with him, I saw a little bit of that, but I saw mostly a guy who was so obsessed with music that took up about 98% of his life, and that was probably the sole cause of a lot of the complexities of his personality. You know, I think he really loved to play music, and he loved to play those old arrangements, and he was always thinking of new ways of playing him. And the image of him as the absent-minded professor type was kind of true. And I think he did a lot of things, sometimes to the detriment of people's personal feelings, without really meaning to. He was just, you know, thinking about the music and what I can do to make it better, and that kind of explains a lot of him. I've never been with a band leader before or since who was so great at getting results from a band. He really made us sound like a Benny Goodman band in an amazingly short period of time.
Did he hurt you ever on the way to making good music?
No, he didn't. You know, that last band he had, and I regret that, we did one studio record that has yet to come out, and I wish people could hear it. But that band was a lot of younger guys that really loved him and respected him, and I think he felt that from us. He did make a lot of changes in the band, but I think if you showed up on the bandstand, ready to play Benny Goodman music for him, and also showed him that you respected him, but you weren't intimidated by him. That was a big help as to yourself. And I got to say, he actually was very kind to me. I found out after he passed on that he tried to get a record contract for me with the label he was on at the time, and offered to produce a record of mine. This is before I had any contract with Concord or anything. And they weren't interested, but the producer told me a few years later, he said, geez, I wish we would have taken him up on it now. So he was really nice to me. You know, we got along pretty well. We talked almost every day on the phone. In fact, I wound up being his, after Lorne Schoenberg left the band, I wound up being his kind of contractor for, 'cause he went through a drummer a week every rehearsal, he just wasn't satisfied with the rhythm section. He kept changing the drummers, and then hiring Louis Belson at great expense to come in at the last minute and do the gigs. But I just wound up going through almost every name in the Manhattan Union book to try to find somebody that he would like. But he was very picky about what he wanted. But then again, after you listen to him play, you kind of think to yourself, well, maybe he's got a right to do this, you know, because he really was the greatest at what he did, I think.
Did you play clarinet or tenor?
No, I played tenor. And, there's a little bit of clarinet doubling. But I gave him some tapes that I'd done playing clarinet. And I guess that was the basis of him telling these people that they should record me. But he never said anything to me about my clarinet playing except, you sound good, or, you know, those kind of things. But the first audition, he auditioned Lauren Schoenberg's band, his big band, for because he wanted to take a big band back out on the road. So he came to a rehearsal session we had, and an hour went by and he didn't show up. So we just started playing some charts, and I was playing the clarinet parts, and we're in the middle of an arrangement, and I've got my eyes closed and playing a solo, and I could actually feel the band change and kind of tense up, and without even knowing that he was in the room, I knew he was there. And then, of course, everybody completely fell apart. And he wound up hiring the whole band.
Did Benny Goodman give you any advice about the clarinet or technique or your sound?
Not specifically to me, but he would say things to the band like he would stop us in the middle of solos and say things like, I want you to sing this solo. I want you to sing it out. And I may have been too young then to realize what he was talking about, but now I know that, you know, he always, through everything, had a sense of melody, a great sense of melody, which by that I mean, even as he was improvising over a complicated set of chord changes, he had a beautiful structure to his solo. You know, it had a beginning, a middle, and an end. And he had such a great melodic sense. And I think he wanted us to do the same thing, to stop thinking about music as a mental exercise and to think about it as music, you know, and to play through a solo, you know, to construct another song in a way to what was going on.
So when he said sing it out, he meant with your voice?
No, he meant sing it out through your instrument, as if you were using your voice. So, in other words, get that sense of phrasing and melody and breathing that the singers have, you know, instead of just, you know, you see these players come right out of college and they've got all this knowledge in the world, but they don't have any soul or real feeling behind the solos. And I think that's what he wanted us to do, to forget about the technique and get more into the feel.
Benny Goodman used a lot of great arrangements by Fletcher Henderson, and you used some of the Henderson arrangements on your new CD, so I thought we should listen to one of those. Why don't we hear Between the Devil and the Deep Blue Sea? This is clarinetist Kemp Poplawski from his new CD, Last Swing of the Century, Big Band Music of Benny Goodman. It's clarinetist Ken Poplawski from his new CD, Last Swing of the Century, Big Band Music of Benny Goodman. What's your attitude toward playing repertory music? Do you try to keep it true to the original recording or use the original arrangement or recording as a jumping off point?
Actually, I take a kind of a different attitude. I don't want anybody to recreate solos, to try to play specifically in the style of the old records. I may be alone in this, because there's this big whole movement of everybody trying to sound like the old records. But to me, the way to keep the music alive is play it in your own fashion, and show the audience that you love this music. But do it in your own way. Otherwise, you're treating the music like a dead music and treating it like a museum piece. And I don't want a concert to turn into a history lesson. I want the people to know that it's still alive. So all we did was use these arrangements as a jumping off point for us. And this is our way of playing these charts.
My guest is clarinetist Ken Poplawski. His new CD is called Last Swing of the Century. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is clarinetist Ken Poplawski. His new CD, Last Swing of the Century, features songs and arrangements associated with the Benny Goodman Band. Were you exposed to Benny Goodman records from your father's collection when you were growing up?
Yeah, my father was an amateur musician, and there was a lot of music around the house, and he was very surprisingly open musically, because he was a very conservative guy otherwise. But we all in the family listened to everything from Benny Goodman to the Beatles to classical music to polka music, which was my first professional job. And it all kind of goes in and goes into the computer there. And so it was nice. And I still like to listen to all kinds of music. And I wind up playing mostly jazz, but I welcome some changes once in a while. But yeah, Benny was a big early influence.
How did you end up playing clarinet?
It's a funny thing. My father brought home a trumpet, tried to play it, gave it up in frustration, gave it to my brother. He became a trumpet player. He next brought home a clarinet, tried it, gave it up, gave it to me. I got stuck with the clarinet and I actually loved it almost from the beginning. I always make a joke out of this, and I tell people I'm very lucky, and this is true, because the next instrument he brought home was the accordion.
And you did can he get play that himself?
Yes, he did. You can get the letters from the accordion players.
So you started playing clarinet, your brother was playing trumpet, and then you played in polka bands together when you were kids.
Yeah, we had a Polish polka band called the Harmony Kings. And I was, I think, around 10, and he was around 12. And we were like this little kid's novelty act around Cleveland, Ohio. And we used to go on the local TV and radio shows. There was a TV show called Polka Varieties. And if you ever remember the SCTV show with the Schmengi brothers, it was so close to this show, it's frightening. But it's like learning how to swim by being thrown into the water. That's how I learned how to play. You know, there we were having to play these long weddings and learn a lot of old standards in addition to the polkas. And the clarinet's function in that music is to improvise. So I kind of learned just by doing it on the job.
Now, imagine playing clarinet excluded you from playing in a lot of rock and roll bands.
Yeah, although we did do our version of Proud Mary with accordion and drums and clarinet. That was a killer with the audience. But, yeah, it did exclude me from that. But I took up saxophone a few years after the clarinet because of that, actually, because it fit in more with rock music and with more of the old standards. So I did my share of different kinds of jobs around Cleveland when I was coming up.
My guest is clarinetist Ken Poplowski. He records for Concord Records and has a new CD of the music of Benny Goodman called Last Swing of the Century. Ken Poplowski, you've studied classical music, and before we talk about studying classical music, I want to feature you playing a classical piece. So let's listen to something from your CD, The Other Portrait, and this features you with the Bulgarian National Symphony. We'll hear you playing the first movement of Dance Preludes by the composer Witold Ludoslavsky. Clarinetist Ken Poplowski from his CD, The Other Portrait. Ken, did you study classical music because you planned on playing classical music, or did you do it just for help with your technique?
A little bit of both. I had a great teacher early on in Cleveland, a man named Al Blazer, who really impressed upon me the need to learn a lot of the classical approach to playing and how it would help everything I did, and it does. It helps with the breathing, with the phrasing, with the articulation of notes. And I always admired, even the jazz players I admired had that classical side to them. Benny did, Jimmy Hamilton from the Duke Ellington Orchestra, Buster Bailey, people like that. So I started studying all of that, the supposed legit stuff. And because I was studying that, I decided to go on into college and go for a degree on the clarinet with the classical thing, even though I always knew I would just play jazz. But I mainly went to college just to keep studying with the same man because he was teaching at Cleveland State. And I wound up going there for a year and a half, and then I got a job on the road with the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra, and then that was it. It all went to pot.
How do you think studying classical technique helped you playing jazz?
Because, it comes back to what I said before about Benny impressing upon us that sense of melodicism. You have to do the same thing if you're playing a piece that is all written out, that somebody wrote a long time ago. You have to put your personality into that piece of music. And you have to first learn the technique, and then the trick is to forget about the technique and just put some music into it. And if you can do that with classical music, that's a big stepping stone to doing it with jazz. And I love that kind of a classical, dark, round sound of the clarinet. It's such a beautiful sound that, for me, that's what I strive to get, even if I'm playing something that's not classical.
There's a piece of yours I want to play from an earlier CD called The Natural Touch, and this is a clarinet bass duet, and the song is How Deep is the Ocean. And I want to play this because I suspect that it really shows off some of the things that you learned with the help of studying classical technique, like the beautiful tone that you have, and also some of the embellishments in your improvisation here sound like they might be inspired in part by some of the classical technique that you learned. Do you want to say anything about this before we hear it?
Just that, you're absolutely right. Even now when I practice, it's mostly etudes, classical etudes, and it all is information that goes into everything you do. So those little embellishments that you're speaking of do come right out of classical technique.
Let's hear it. This is clarinetist Ken Poplowski. That's my guest Ken Poplawski on clarinet with Murray Wall on bass from Poplawski's 1992 CD, The Natural Touch. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is clarinetist Ken Poplawski. His new CD, Last Swing of the Century, features songs and arrangements associated with the Benny Goodman Band. And with your own band, a lot of the repertoire that you play is songs, you know, old standards, and it's almost wrong to call them standards because there's a lot of them are songs that not that many people know. But they're real songs. They're not just like riff-based things or heads that people play just to improvise on. And I'm wondering what attracts you to song.
Well, I have a very low boredom threshold. Honestly. And for me, if I'm bored standing up there playing, the audience has got to be asleep. So I want to... The kind of records I like, you know, it's there's something about all those old writers. They constructed these beautiful pieces of music that told a whole story in 32 bars, and they're very interesting harmonically. They go to all these different places, and there's so much material out there to draw on. And I'm not a composer, you know, so what I do is interpret other people's material. So I love to dig up old songs. You're absolutely right. And I do think about the lyrics, and I think about what the song is trying to say. There's nothing worse than somebody's record of all original tunes. And there would be nothing worse than my record of all original tunes. You know, not everybody is a Gershwin or a Ellington or a Thelonious Monk. So why not? There's so much to draw from out there that hasn't been explored. You might as well take advantage of it.
Where do you go digging for new tunes?
Well, I've got some mutual musical friends like Greg and Howard Alden and Ben Aronoff, my piano player, who are all kind of archaeologists. You know, we're all looking for through old song folios, song books, or you hear somebody play something. I've stolen a lot of my best material from Frank Sinatra, actually. I'm a big fan of some of the great singers. So it's not hard to find material. You know, you just a little bit of listening, a little bit of research in a music store or a library, and there you go.
Do you think you've learned a lot about phrasing by listening to singers like Sinatra?
Absolutely, yes. You know, he always said he learned a lot from Tommy Dorsey. And I got to tell him this once because we did a gig with him with Benny. We weren't together, but he was on the act and Benny was on the act. And I told him, I said, you know, you learned from Tommy, and now all of us are learning from you, which is true. A lot of instrumentalists will now tell you that they cite Sinatra as a big influence. His phrasing was unbelievable. His way of putting feeling into a song was just unmatchable. To me, he was the best male singer in jazz. And then I worked with Mel Torme, and he was... also a big influence. He was just such a great musician and so flawless technically. He was unbelievable. So, yeah, I try to learn from everybody, really.
Do you like to learn the lyrics of a song when you're going to play it so you can think about that?
Yes, I really do. It doesn't mean you have to memorize every word, but I think it's important to learn what was meant when they wrote the song. And then you can take what you want from it. But if you're playing a ballad, it's nice to know what kind of a ballad it is, if it's a really haunting ballad or if it's a you know, just a song to try to woo some young lady, you know. And my goal, ultimate goal, is to accomplish without words what the great singers accomplish using the words.
Well, Ken Poplawski, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Ken Poplawski's new CD is called Last Swing of the Century. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Monique Nazareth, with Alan Tu, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Sam Adams. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the National Endowment for the Humanities, expanding American understanding of human experience and culture. And from Little Brown and Company, publishers of Legacy, a biography of Moses and Walter Annenberg by Christopher Ogden, in hardcover wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Helen Bamber, the founder of the Medical Foundation for the Care of Victims of Torture, which is based in London. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.